This is an iHeart podcast.
We now have a Speaker of the House. Time to get to business. We'll talk about that with Chip Roy. We'll talk about that with Josh Hammer. We have a This Week in Wokeism. We're going to have a blast tonight on I'm Right.
The gentleman from the great state of California and the next Speaker of the 118th Congress, Kevin McCarthy.
That was easy, huh? I never thought we'd get up here.
Okay. Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy. 15 tries. 15 tries. You know what? We're going to pause on that for just a moment. Let's have a talk. Just you and me talking about life. We'll get back to Kevin McCarthy and Speaker of the House and all those other things, but we don't have very many frank life conversations anymore as a society. I know you do, and I do. You do in your personal life, but as a society, any tough conversation is generally avoided. Let's have a talk about leverage. We don't like to talk about things like leverage because it makes people uncomfortable. It makes people feel like you're playing an angle. Oh, he's just in it for his own selfish interests, but aren't we all in it somehow, some way, for our own selfish interests? Doesn't have to apply just to Speaker of the House votes or the business world. Doesn't it apply in your own personal life if you're being really, really honest with yourself? Fellas, want to go golfing with the boys this weekend? No, I know you could just go, but it certainly doesn't hurt to ask the wife if she has anything extra you can do for her on Saturday before you take off for beers and 18 holes on Sunday at noon, does it? Ladies, getting ready to ask for some extra drapes in the house might cost a bit of money. Well, a nice dinner or two can sure grease those skids, can't they? Leverage. Leverage is important in life. Leverage matters. And it's important to use it when you have it, if you can use it smartly. Because I want to talk about this. You hear Kevin McCarthy getting up and saying things like he's going to hold the swamp accountable.
We will hold the swamp accountable. From the withdrawal of Afghanistan to the origins of COVID and to the weaponization of the FBI.
No, let's pause for a moment here. I'm still cynical, Jesse. Let's just say I'm cautiously optimistic about those things. I am optimistic, cautiously, but who was that up here? Up there, was that you? Did you take the gavel? Was that me up there? Weaponization of the FBI? Why would he get up and say, you know why he got up and said that? Do you know why, as part of the rules package, we have single subject bills, which we've needed forever? They're going to vote for term limits. Don't worry, they'll vote them down, but they're going to vote for term limits. They have a special committee chaired by Jim Jordan, specifically focused now on the weaponization of the federal government. My goodness, that sounds outstanding. That's awesome. Why'd we get all that? We got all that because 20 people in the House of Representatives realized that they had leverage and they chose to use said leverage. And on this show, they're all going to get a shout out by name. Here they are: Andy Biggs, Dan Bishop, Lauren Boebert, Josh Breachin, Michael Cloud, Andrew Clyde, Eli Crane, Byron Donalds, Matt Gaetz, Bob Good, Paul Gosar, Andy Harris, Anna Paulina Luna, Mary Miller, Ralph Norman, Andy Ogle, Scott Perry, Matt Rosendale, Keith Self, and Chip Roy. Chip Roy, who will be joining us very, very shortly here. Now, let's just understand something, and let's be real, real honest with ourselves as we take another little sidetrack before I get to Chip and some other things. Do you remember COVID? Not COVID when it was hot and heavy. COVID in the very, very beginning. Do you remember COVID? Because I'll tell you, I remember COVID. And you know what I remember most about COVID? It actually wasn't Fauci or Trump or Burks. It actually wasn't the media. It wasn't the American people. It wasn't any of that. What sticks with me from COVID, it will always stick with me, was watching 90% of the right, politicians and pundits on the right, 90% of them come out and loudly proclaim their support for 15 days to slow the spread. That's right. It's only 15 days. Hey, guys, millions may die. Taking the company line, handing the communists everything they needed to completely wreck the country. People have a rose-colored lens when they look at their own history. It wasn't the left that I remember. It was the right. And I remember the same people out there shouting from the rooftops, "It's only 15 days." They were the same people telling you for the last week that these 20 brave ones, if we're going to call them that, I realize they all have different motivations, but that these 20, that they were selfish, that they were, what is that word they used? Terrorists, that they were traitors, that this is going to end up with a Democrat speaker. This might be the end of the world. Oh my goodness, what are we doing? We didn't elect a speaker in the first 15 minutes. It was not the left. It was the right. It was the people you watch on television. It was the people you listen to on the radio. It was the people who write for those publications. You wake up every single morning, you grab your phone. Oh, what are they saying on this publication? I won't remember the left. They did the same despicable stuff they always do. I will remember the right. And here's the thing. I want you to remember the right as well. Because that person on the right you watch, listen to, read, who was wrong at the beginning of COVID, seems to get every issue wrong at the very beginning of it. You know, St. George Floyd, COVID, the speakership, that same person who seems to be wrong initially every single time is somebody you need to drop and cut out of your life, because here's what the problem we face in this country truly, truly is. The problem we face is not the communists. We know what they are. We know what they want. We know they are ravenous. We know they were never quit. We know we have to defeat them. We know all that. All that stuff's baked in the cake. We got it. The communists suck. The problem we have in this country is the weapons-grade loser mentality on the right. The second someone actually takes a real stance, the second someone stands for something, uses their leverage, tries to get real things accomplished, the second things get a little, uncomfortable, guys, that guy you watch on TV, listen to on the radio, or read at National Review immediately thinks that this is too uncomfortable. Let's just lay down. Let's give up. We can't fight like this, guys. 90% of the right are a bunch of low-T GOP weenie losers. And I'm not just talking about the politicians. All those people who've spent all those years ranting against the establishment in the swamp couldn't get down on their knees and kiss Kevin McCarthy's butt fast enough the second things got a little bit uncomfortable for a speakership vote. That's the truth. And have you seen the things these 20 brave souls got? We mentioned them. Things like actually going after the administrative state in a real way. Single issue bills, so many other things, issue after issue after issue. They're all outstanding. I could read them all for you right now. I will not, but just know, I want you to go get a list and I want you to read that list for yourself of all the things, all the concessions they got from Kevin McCarthy. And more importantly than that, I want you to remember all the people on the right, not the politician, the pundits on the right who stood against those things. You'd have none of them if 90% of the right had their way. Remember that. With that, let's bring in my friend Chip Roy, who I've been blowing up his phone trying to get him to run for senator. Don't think that's going to stop anytime soon, Chip. You might as well go ahead and block my number. But let's focus on the whole speakership vote thing for now. You were out early, and as you often are, you were bold about your opposition, about the stances you were going to take. Tell us why. Everyone's put a lot of words in your mouth. You tell us why.
Well, first of all, it was really important after the election to recognize that the American people sent a message they do want change. Now, we probably could have performed a little better in November if we had done a variety of things differently, in my opinion. But here we are. We have the House majority. The American people expect us to do what we said we would do. And given that we had a fairly thin majority, it was very clear that we needed to establish how this game is going to be played and make it very clear that we need to sit down at the table and advance conservative priorities. A few of my colleagues leaned into the fight with hardcore saying, look, we're opposing McCarthy. I raised a lot of questions saying, well, I need the leader to make clear what he's going to do to lead us forward. And we sent a memo out in early December, December 8th, where we outlined what we believe were the key areas that needed to be addressed by any speaker candidate. So we spent the last month almost exactly negotiating through those things. It took a while to get where we needed to go. Frankly, probably could have and should have been done before January 3rd. But sometimes it just takes the pressure of getting through the moment in order to get where you need to go. And look, we had a great week where the American people got to see 434 people in a chamber with people raising ideas and thoughts and differences of opinion and standing up for them. And I think that resonated. I think the American people saw that. And I think all the talking heads, there was like a 180-degree switch in the middle of last week by a lot of the talking heads who started the week going, oh, those knuckleheads, they're all in it for personal gain. And, you know, then they started saying, wait a second, they're just trying to push for openness, open rules, be able to cut spending. They want to limit spending. That sounds a lot like why we actually sent them there. So crazy, we're with them.
Chip, will you please expand on limiting spending? Now, that's music to my ears. Just take a hacksaw to that whole thing, but explain what's getting cut, because I'm positive every low-T GOP loser in D.C. is talking about you taking away grandma's Social Security check right now.
Well, you're exactly right. It took approximately 0.2 seconds for everybody to be saying, you're going to slaughter defense, you're going to take away your ability to defend our country, you're going to hurt Social Security and Medicare. Everybody calm down. Here's what we did. Number one, we changed the process so that we have to be able to see the rules for the bills that are produced for 72 hours. And we've got a rules committee, which is the one who decides how this stuff gets to the floor, that now has conservatives on it that can enforce those rules. We have single subject. We have germaneness. That all changes the tenor, so you can't pile a lot of stuff in there. But here's the important part. We required that we be able to offer amendments on the floor during the appropriations fight to cut spending. In other words, we would have an open rule process for cutting spending. That's been embraced. That's a big deal. We haven't done that for years. And then the final part, we got an agreement, and we talked to the speaker about this, about limiting spending, that we would cap spending at fiscal year 22 levels. Now, that's still an outrageously high level of spending, Jesse. But in order to balance the budget over 10 years, in order to get that accomplished and not undermine our ability to spend what we need for defense, we agreed to do an FY22 cap. That is would be one of the biggest reductions in spending in history. And we would be, frankly, that would be an enormous win. But here's the key. You got to use the leverage points to do it. And that's when we get to the spending mechanism in September, or say in July, when we are going through June or July, the debt ceiling fight.
Leverage. Seems like someone else was just talking about that. All right. Now, explain this to me, Gio. Explain to me all the opposition towards it. Because when you lay things out, to hear you talk about that, a moderate spending cut, that's nothing scary or drastic, certainly not what I know you would probably do if you were dictator. We're talking about single issue bills. We're talking about a term limit vote. We're talking about accountability for the FBI, which we'll get to in a second. Now, this is conservatism 101 for what people want today, and yet 90% of the GOP pundit class opposed you for the last week. Why?
Well, here's the thing. We laid out in very clear terms on December 8th that we wanted certain structural reforms. We were able to get a lot of those things adopted and or agreed to, I should say. But there were the key things that mattered for substantive issues, spending, being able to fight for the border. So you're putting up the Texas border plan. We wanted to make sure we were going to advance the Texas border plan, which all but one members of the Republican delegation from Texas supported and got behind, because it actually focuses on security. We were able to mandate, you know, hey, we need to end the COVID mandates. We wanted to make sure that we were going to get a term limits vote. There were things that we thought were really important that weren't a part of the commitment that needed to be put forward. But what we were able to do, I think, was show that there is a backlash from the swamp when you dare stand up and say, here are the things that need to be done. And then at the end of the day, we showed that we were able to win by taking it to the American people. That was on display when Mike Rogers and Matt Gaetz had a little bit of tension on Friday night. And look, I think Matt has handled that very well, and Mike too subsequently. They've on social media said, hey, we're going to work together. But that was, hey, the ones who are the insurgents pushing and saying we need change, and then the establishment, the order, the chairman saying, no, we're not going to change. We need to do that. As I said yesterday on one of the shows, a little temporary conflict is really important in order to force the changes here so the Republicans can do what we said we would do. I don't fear those conflicts. We wake up tomorrow and we all figure out how to work together because that's what we're paid to do. But damn it, I'm going to force that when it needs to be forced.
Amen. All right, finally, the FBI. This is my biggest issue because I believe what's happening right now with the administrative state will end this nation if it is not fixed. I love that we have some sort of accountability coming. What does it look like? What do we have? What don't we have?
Well, first of all, you know, Jim Jordan is obviously an extraordinary chairman of the Judiciary Committee. Yes. Proud to serve on it, proud to serve with him. What we've been striving for and pushing for an independent church-style committee is to elevate the extent to which we are saying that we need broad powers across the entirety of all of the various agencies. And then we decided ultimately in the end, rather than independently doing that, to marry it with the Judiciary Committee as a powerful select subcommittee where Jim would be able to be in charge of that from the top as the chairman. We're still figuring out how to structure that, and there's a number of ways to do that in terms of personnel. But it's really critically important that we go after the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, the intel agencies, all of the power brokers for what they've done. And here's the important part. Also, Fauci and all of those involved with NIH and CDC and the FDA, all of the decisions that they have made, absolutely abhorrent what they've done to the American people. And Jesse, you've been one of the ones leading on that, along with my good friend Steve Dace and some others, making clear that this is completely unacceptable. And we need to make sure that this weaponization of government, it's made clear it's not just the FBI. It's not just intelligence agencies. It's the whole apparatus of bureaucrats who are at war with the American people. And that needs to be made clear. That needs to be put on display. And then we need to lay out a roadmap on what we need to deal with it in terms of defunding or transforming these agencies.
Congressman, go get them. We're rooting for you.
Thanks, Jesse. God bless. Take care.
All right, we're going to hear what Josh Hammer thinks about all this next. All that may have made you uncomfortable, but I'm right, and so is Chip. You know what else is right? Not getting scammed anymore. Not getting stuck in a timeshare you don't want. And I know what's happened to you already. I know about the annual fees. I get all the emails, annual fees doubling, special assessments. I know. You're one phone call away from getting out of all that. One. Or go to the website. Lone Star Transfer, it's what they do. It is their entire business, taking families who are stuck in a timeshare and legally and permanently getting them out. You're just a phone call away. Call them. 18,000, over 18,000 times they have done this. Successful, 99% of the time. 844-310-2646. 844-310-2646 or LoneStarTransfer.com.
Each morning, the President of the United States receives a highly classified briefing on the most important issues facing the country. It's called the President's Daily Brief, or PDB. It's delivered by America's spies and analysts. Well, now you can hear your very own PDB in the form of a podcast hosted by me, Brian Dean Wright, a former CIA operations officer. Each morning at 6 a.m. Eastern, I'll bring you 15 to 20 minutes of the most important issues facing the country, giving you the critical intelligence and analysis you need to start your morning.
There's no reason for us to keep voting. Keep allowing these speeches that just degraded and diminished and insulted Kevin McCarthy. We didn't have to keep doing that.
Oh, it was so uncomfortable. We argued and we fought. It was so icky. Joining me now, my friend Josh Hammer of the Josh Hammer Show, also opinion editor at Newsweek. Josh, why all the fighting? It's only America.
Jesse, happy new year. Good to see you again. Jesse, thank you personally as well for being one of the relatively few sane conservative talking heads who actually got this one right. What is wrong? Like, seriously, what is wrong with the people on our proverbial side, especially in kind of the legacy kind of corporate right of center media, who just had meltdown after meltdown about these infidels, these rebels, these terrorists? What is the plan? Who is the speaker? Guys, what is wrong with a few days of deliberating to make sure that the living, breathing embodiment of K Street corrupt Republicanism, which is Kevin McCarthy, that is always who Kevin McCarthy has been since the day that he ascended to the U.S. House from Bakersfield, California. What is wrong with a few days of deliberating to make sure that he becomes a very weak speaker and is able to then concede or is able to grant concessions to conservative firebrands like our mutual friend Chip Roy and so forth? There's nothing wrong with that. There is literally nothing wrong with that. And what I would personally like to see, Jesse, I would personally like to see if those folks who since day one, since before the first ballot in the House was even cast, were going to the mattresses to excoriate all of McCarthy's detractors who were trying to kind of bolster his chances. I would like to hear those commentators now say whether or not they support the concessions. Do they support the fact that three House Freedom Caucus members will now be on the very influential House Rules Committee? Do they support the fact that there will be now 12 individual appropriations packages as opposed to one gargantuan, grotesque $1.7 to $2 trillion whatever omnibus bill? You know, a modicum of intellectual honesty, I think, at this particular moment would be appreciated. So I'm kind of fed up with it, to be honest with you. It was a very eye-opening week, I thought.
Okay, Josh, I actually want to ask you a very important question. In my opinion, it's generally the most important question. Why? And this is what I mean. Now, I have my own theory on why, but okay, politicians are weenies. That sucks. But so many of these people who spent the last week yelling about a 3 or 4 day argument on the House floor are people I grew up reading. I grew up following. I grew up watching on television. I grew up listening to the radio show. Grew up always considered them being on our side and freedom fighters. And I'm not hesitant to say I've learned a lot from them. And yet at the first sign of a little tiff, they all couldn't lay down fast enough. Why?
Jesse, it's an unpleasant question to ask, but it's a question that has to be asked. Look, I mean, I have read multiple of Mark Levin's books. I mean, I think Mark Levin's Liberty and Tyranny, which is kind of his Tea Party era manifesto, I think he published that book around 2009 or so. That book was very influential. I remember reading it when I was in college. I was in college at the time. I mean, I've read multiple of Mark's books, actually. And, you know, Mark is not the only one. I'm not trying to kind of cast fingers solely on him. There were really a galling number of very prominent right-of-center commentators in the radio space and the columnist space. And I guess the only obvious answer that comes to mind, Jesse, and I'm just speculating here, I don't pretend to know this, but the answer that comes to mind is just access, is access and influence. Like, you kind of have to assume that Kevin McCarthy personally and his closest allies, his chief of staff, you know, his closest deputies and whips in the House Republican caucus probably called up a lot of these folks and said, you know, if you do this, then, you know, we will kind of value your opinion on this bill. I'm just speculating here. I have no inside knowledge of how this kind of thing goes down whatsoever. I would like to think that I personally am not compromised like this when it comes to my calling the shots in the commentariat space. But I have to think that kind of access and ability to possibly kind of shape legislation or shape the governance of the chamber, the U.S. House, is probably what's going on here.
Yeah, boy, maybe it's just that simple. I don't know, Josh, it's weird. Maybe they lost my number. I didn't get any of those phone calls. All right, now, Kevin McCarthy, what kind of power does he have? You mentioned that he's very, very restricted, effectively neutered by a lot of this. Okay, what should we be watching out for? Because you're going to have to forgive me if I don't trust him.
No, nor should you trust him. I mean, look, Kevin McCarthy, like I just said, I mean, he is who he is, and he is the same man that he has been since he got to the U.S. House. There is one thing and one thing only that Kevin McCarthy has always cared about, and it is Kevin McCarthy's own power. It is his own career advancement. It is his own kind of climbing through the ranks. And he is willing to go to any measure to do so. He is K Street's favorite Republican because he is infamously chummy with right-of-center lobbyists. He is corrupted by various domestic and foreign interests because Kevin McCarthy is all about the quid pro quo, I'll trade you X for Y, the compromise kind of game. He's a big proponent of manufacturing crises. He loves these kind of $1.7 trillion last-minute omnibus voice down the throats of the members style of governance there. So these concessions that, you know, Chip Roy and the merry bands of quote-unquote terrorists, the concessions that they were able to extract include, from my perspective, crucially, a single-member motion to vacate, which of course means that any single member of the U.S. House can actually force a full vote to vacate the Speaker's chair. And, you know, I saw Chip give an interview to one of the Sunday shows, I guess it was this past weekend. I don't remember. I think it was CNN. I can't remember which Sunday show it was. And basically asked him, like, do you plan to stand on guard to potentially use this single member motion to vacate? And he kind of, you know, he didn't give a very straight answer, but he pretty clearly said yes. So I think Chip and a handful of others are going to be kind of watching Kevin McCarthy like a hawk now. But one thing that stands out in particular that I'm very excited about is the fact that they were able to get a guarantee that there will be these 12 individual appropriations bills. So if you take that seriously, these are the 12 bills that fund the government every fiscal year, year in and year out. That is a huge, huge win for fiscal sanity. I mean, the fact that we will not have to face, hopefully not to face, these gargantuan last minute omnibus $2 trillion or the government shuts down situation there. But again, the fail-safe mechanism is this motion to vacate, and it's just very, very, very good for conservatives that they were able to extract that.
Who is Kevin McCarthy, Josh? Now, obviously, everyone knows who he is now, but and I know you've known who he is for a long time, but the average Joe generally doesn't. You mentioned Bakersfield, California. You mentioned he's chummy with lobbyists. Now, he did stand against, loudly, publicly stood against that $1.7 trillion omnibus bill. Is this guy Mitch McConnell light? Is he better? Is he the Antichrist? Who is he?
Look, Kevin McCarthy is a career politician. I mean, he was in the California state legislature before he went to the U.S. House. Kevin McCarthy also went on the cover of a book along with Paul Ryan and Eric Cantor, who, of course, have since left the House. The three of them kind of were the very kind of public-facing portion of this Young Guns program that the Republican Party, around the time of the Tea Party era, 2010, 2011 or so, they're really trying to kind of promote this. They were supposed to be kind of the young, up-and-coming face of the Republican Party. But again, the problem that so many of us who are kind of conviction conservatives, who are kind of ideologically motivated conservatives, the same problem that all of us have with Kevin McCarthy is that no one is able to discern what his putative principles are. Now, he kind of unveiled this commitment for America during this past campaign cycle. It seemed to me like he wasn't necessarily particularly eager to unveil it. His hand was kind of forced by a lot of people who were kind of saying, what's the plan? What's the plan? I, you know, other than the most kind of like mealy-mouthed milquetoast of all Republican policies, like cutting taxes, like boosting domestic energy production, I'm sure Kevin McCarthy supports that. But other than that kind of 1980s-style pablum, I'm really just not entirely sure what Kevin McCarthy stands for. Because again, he's not a conviction politician. He is a pure kind of power for me, woe to thee-style politician. That's really who he is to his core.
Josh, I just mentioned the Antichrist, and I forgot that you're Jewish. Do Jews believe in the Antichrist?
Jesse, I have to say that the Antichrist is not a particularly important figure in Jewish theology, but, you know, I chose to kind of roll with your question, my friend.
Thanks, Josh. It's anytime. Josh Hammer, the Josh Hammer Show. Let's see you, brother.
All right, see you, man.
I didn't know. I had to ask. If I don't ask, we don't know, right? All right, we're not done yet. We still have This Week in Wokeism to come. We still have you being allergy-free to come. It's right around the corner. Did you know that? In as much time as it takes to get three Eden Pure Thunderstorms shipped to your home, that's the only time you have left to suffer with allergies. You don't have to. I suffered forever. Always taking that over-the-counter allergy medication. And did you know your body gets used to it, and so then you have to switch to a different over-the-counter allergy medication? I don't take any of that anymore. No more cotton mouth at night because of that stupid stuff. Nope. I bought three Eden Pure Thunderstorms, and now I'm allergy-free. I keep three actually here at the studio. I keep three at the house, cleaning my air constantly. Constantly cleaning it. They're wonderful. Go to EdenPureDeals.com. Promo code Jesse gets you $200 off a three-pack. That's a three-pack for under $200. EdenPureDeals.com, code Jesse. We'll be back. Military exercises as we go into This Week in Wokeism, because it's time now for This Week in Wokeism. But military exercises. Here's the thing about military exercises historically. Sometimes they're actually exercises. Just practice. I'm just going out there practicing, guys. Got to do a little beep-beep, just practicing. I did these a bunch when I was in the Marine Corps. We'd go out and we'd be in the middle of California. And we obviously weren't invading California, sadly, but we weren't invading California. So we're just out there doing an exercise. And then there's the other kind. Sometimes military exercises aren't really exercises at all. Sometimes they're mobilization. Remember, mobilization is simply moving necessary things in place. And sometimes they're mobilization and rehearsals. Sometimes it's a big dress rehearsal for the real thing. I only bring this up, I don't know, because China has launched a massive sea and air combat exercise over the weekend. Taiwan, we're talking jets, the works. It looks like, and you never know, that look, this could be the first kind, it could just be exercises, but it sure looks like Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party has decided now is the time. Maybe now is a good time to bring up a couple things. One, Joe Biden famously committed U.S. troops to this conflict with the other major power on the planet. Kind of seems like a big deal. And two, while the Chinese were giving their troops in testosterone injections, let's look in on what the U.S. military was doing. Well, we're renaming infrastructure. We're renaming bases. 9 Army bases, to be specific. 2 Navy ships, more than 1,000 items at America's military installations. We're also removing a Confederate monument from Arlington National Cemetery. But wait, there's more. The State Department has announced they're making $1.5 million available in grant funding for LGBTQI communities. Yes, you see, while China is putting nuclear attack subs in the water day after day and making sure they're ready to go on conquest, the United States of America, or let's be honest, the U.S. of Gay, we're tearing down Confederate monuments, and the State Department is handing out cash to every rainbow brigade in the world right now. You see, only one country is taking defense seriously. The other country, let's be honest, their military is more focused on their new national religion. And that's us. Here in the U.S. of Gay, the Department of Defense has simply a different mission. They're not worried about stopping China, not worried about protecting Taiwan, not worried about protecting America, to be frank. I mean, here's one of our 4-star admirals.
So we really want to base our treatment and to affirm and to support and empower these youth, not to limit their participation in activities and sports, and even limit their ability to get gender affirmation treatment in their state.
Don't think, hey, look, if you want some comfort, don't think that this was just in the military all this stuff is going on. I want you to listen very closely to this therapist from Nashville.
When I looked at a client's mom and said, "Do you want a transgender kid or a dead kid?" Horrified looks from everyone in the room.
Okay. We have a huge problem in this country. We have a new national religion. It is a destructive religion. It is an evil religion. There is no bottom to the U.S. of Gay. You should understand that. People ask, when does this end? Because clearly they're grooming children now. Our friend Kira Davis at Red State has a story out about a shocking 600 Chicago educators grooming children. This has become a nation where We prey on kids routinely, not just teachers, doctors, the system itself, all part of this US of gay downward cycle. Where does it end? It doesn't end because evil doesn't actually have a bottom at all. That is the truth. Evil has no bottom. It doesn't stop until good comes up and stops it. They are after your kids. All right, we still have a ton more to get to. You're gonna wanna stay tuned for the raccoons. I'll explain. But I know something else. We have to be ready. We have to be very ready to fight. Because again, it doesn't stop until we stop. That's just the fact. They're not gonna wake up one day and say, we should stop. That means we can't be a bunch of low-T GOP weenies. We can't. We simply can't. We can't be a low-T GOP anymore. The entire right needs to be on a male vitality stack or female vitality stack from chalk. On top of all the medical benefits, let me just tell you, as someone who's been taking a male vitality stack for, gosh, 8-9 months now, how you feel is just incredible. I've got 60-some-year-old men writing in saying they haven't had this much energy since they were in their 20s. Ladies, same thing for you for the female vitality stack. And they're 35% off right now. CHOQ.com, promo code Jesse, gets you 35% off a subscription. Chalk.com, promo code Jesse. We'll be back. We need to do more culture stuff on the show, and I mean like pop culture, entertainment stuff. The problem is I'm so old. I mean, look at all the graying beard and the receding hair. I'm so old I never know who anyone is anymore. My sons will bring up somebody's name and sounds like an alien or something. I have no idea. So we need to bring Emily on more often. Joining me now, Emily Jashinsky, culture editor with The Great Federalist. Okay, Emily, the Golden Globes. Why should I care as an old man?
Yeah, I know. It's actually kind of hard, even as someone who follows this stuff, to care about the Golden Globes. But they took a little recess last year. They're back this week. They were protested so hard, basically by Hollywood's ever-present woke brigade, because they did a survey and found out there was not a single Black journalist in the voting committee of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which is pretty funny from the sort of like hypocrisy standard that the people who complain the most about all of these various things were failing so hard on their own measures. They're back this year. They're doing a lot of splashy advertising, and they're trying to sort of reappear as the booze-fueled sort of award season romp where celebrities just let loose. So it's kind of a test to see whether the so-called vibe shift has actually hit Hollywood, is actually going to trickle into pop culture. Are people actually so sick of woke nonsense, of cancel culture, that the Golden Globes can be a little bit more fun again? I don't know, but I think it'll be a test of that to some extent.
I know these award shows are a lot of fun for Hollywood people types, but is this something that the audience actually cares about? Do people watch these? And I'm not insulting people if that's what you're into, but I've never watched them. I've never understood why people do, but are these things a big deal?
There was an amazing chart that went around last week showing all of the top broadcasts in America over the course of the last year. And it's just football down the line. Football, football, football. They used little emojis to show it. And there was one, and it was the Academy Awards out of like 100 that was entertainment related. And it was way down. I think it was like the 70th most popular, something to that extent. So it's not nearly as popular as it used to be. And it's not nearly as popular as American football and sports still are in this country. For Hollywood, of course, they've started to award themselves for these more art house films. And they're not giving it to, say, like Top Gun Maverick, right? And I don't know if anybody would call that an Academy Award winning film. Maybe I would, but they're not awarding the Titanics. They're not awarding the Lord of the Rings, these big blockbuster movies. And that's part of the reason why the audience just doesn't care anymore, because they're not seeing the films, the sort of artsy films that are getting awarded more and more. So it's harder for them to draw an audience when they're more and more disconnected from the broader American movie-going audience anyway.
Artsy. Gosh, that just sounds awful. Artsy. All right. Harry, of course, you can't turn on the television or get in the grocery aisle and look at the magazines without seeing this guy's stupid face everywhere. Here's Harry recently.
But then you add in the race element, which was what the press, British press, jumped on straight away. I went into this incredibly naive. I had no idea the British press was so bigoted. Hell, I was probably bigoted before the relationship with Meghan.
You think you were bigoted before the relationship with Meghan?
I don't know. Put it this way, I didn't see what I now see.
That's so great. I'll never get over that. I was racist until I met a hot black chick. All right, Emily, why are these people all over everywhere? I just don't know much about the royal family. What's with the press tour now? Who are these people?
I know. Well, so they have a deal with Netflix where they launched this docuseries that's actually been pretty popular. Lots of people are watching it. But what that means isn't just people love Harry and Meghan. It means, you know, some percentage of the audience is obviously hate watching this because the level of entitlement and just complaining from some of the wealthiest and most powerful people on planet Earth actually draws a lot of ire to the point where people want to pay attention to them exactly so that they can have opinions about how horrible they are. People are like really deeply annoyed by them. And Prince Harry said a couple of interesting things there. First of all, he's infamous for wearing a Nazi uniform to a Halloween party when he was younger. So yeah, maybe you were bigoted, Prince Harry. And secondly, he's being ridiculous to say the British press jumped on the race angle right away with Meghan Markle. She was completely popular in both the UK and in America when she first came on the scene. Actually, people really liked her until she started becoming more sort of personally indulgent. And it came off as whiny, and it came off as totally disconnected from the planet when she's jetting everywhere on private flights and complaining about the environment, when she's stirring the pot constantly and then pointing the finger at other people. So there's just, it's fodder for the way that, you know, very wealthy, privileged people see themselves as victims. And that really sets off a lot of people. And I think that's partially why this conversation is so popular.
All right, let's ask a political question here as we wrap this thing up here. The GOP and big tech. Amazingly, because most people aren't on social media, most people aren't on Twitter. Amazingly, the Twitter files just isn't getting a whole lot of play, but there has been some shocking revelations in the Twitter files. We now have a GOP House. We don't have the Senate. We don't have the presidency. Are we going to get anything done?
There's a lot of pressure on House Republicans to actually really, really ramp up the pressure on these investigations. So the public wants to see it. And Freedom Caucus members who threw their weight around really successfully over the course of the last week know that the public wants them to demand this. And there's already talk of subpoenas going to the White House for their relationship with big tech over the last couple of years to really peer into and open this up. And so now that the Twitter files have come out, that actually gives House Republican investigators more fodder to figure out what subpoenas to send. We know the January 6th committee shattered a bunch of precedents when it comes to subpoenas. Twitter files revealed Adam Schiff's staff was looking to get accounts, for instance, silenced on Twitter. Well, I wonder where there could be a subpoena in that direction. So I think the confluence of the Twitter files and a new Republican House coming in and having a lot of pressure on them with a slim majority to probe some of this stuff, it's actually a good sort of timing for both of those things, because you could see subpoenas start to fly. You could see the investigation starting to go in a more targeted direction because of the Twitter files and because House Republicans have so much pressure on them. So I think the next few months, next 6 months, might be really instructive in this topic.
Awesome. Emily, come back soon. I appreciate you.
Thanks, Jesse.
All right. We got to lighten the mood coming up. You know what else we have? Liz Wheeler. The Liz Wheeler Show is now on the first, every single night, 7 p.m. Eastern time. Does that count as night or is that evening? Whatever, 7 p.m. Eastern time, Liz Wheeler, right here, Monday through Friday. We'll be back. All right, it's time to lighten the mood. That was a lot to pack into one show, wasn't it? And what lightens the mood more than a raccoon getting caught red-handed? I'll see you tomorrow.
Each morning, the President of the United States receives a highly classified briefing on the most important issues facing the country. It's called the President's Daily Brief, or PDB. It's delivered by America's spies and analysts. Well, now you can hear your very own PDB in the form of a podcast hosted by me, Brian Dean Wright, a former CIA operations officer. Each morning at 6 a.m. Eastern, I'll bring you 15 to 20 minutes of the most important issues facing the country, giving you the critical intelligence and analysis you need to start your morning.
This is an iHeart podcast.